It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine, discuss Russia's Victory Day parade in Moscow, and we analyse Russia's wartime influence inside and without Ukraine.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Thursday, the 9th of May, 2 years and 76 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our Berlin correspondent James Rothwell, senior foreign correspondent Roland Oliphant, and our guest is political scientist and managing director at the Henry Jackson Society, Aliona Hilivko. We start by looking at the latest news from Ukraine. Let's start by looking at the impact on Ukraine's energy grid then. After weeks of Russian strikes, Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said yesterday that Russian attacks have destroyed or damaged over 800 heating facilities, reducing Ukraine's generation capacity by up to 8 gigawatt hours. In their summary, the Kyiv Independent wrote that Russia's latest attack overnight on May the 8th against Poltava, Kirovohrad, Zaporizhzhia, Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, Kyiv and Vinnytsia oblasts mainly did target energy infrastructure. Ukraine's largest private energy company, DTEC, said that three thermal plants were seriously damaged. Linked to this, two hydropower plants in Ukraine were severely damaged and were no longer in operation after Russian bombardments earlier this week, the state energy company said on Thursday. As of today, all hydro generation has suffered devastating damage, it said in a statement on Telegram. They also added that a significant financial resources and efforts would be required to repair the damage and to restore the plant's operations. So what's Ukraine doing about this? Well, on Thursday, the Energy Ministry said that Ukraine plans to double electricity imports after the powerful attacks on their energy system. The imports are expected to rise to over 16,000 megawatt hours versus just over 7,000 megawatt hours. Again, the ministry released this on Telegram. They said, today, at Ukraine's request, emergency electricity supplies have already been made from Poland, Romania and Slovakia, and emergency assistance will be provided during evening peak hours of electricity consumption. Elsewhere in Ukraine, Russian shelling overnight killed two people in the southern city of Nikopol. Of the 20 drones launched by Moscow overnight, 17 were destroyed. This comes from the Ukrainian Air Force. To remind ourselves, Nikopol regularly comes under fire from Russian forces positioned across the Dnipro River and has been essentially on the front line since late 2022. Regional Governor Sergei Lysak said enemy artillery took the lives of a 62-year-old man and a 65-year-old woman, and he published photos of a house with its roof on fire and several other damaged buildings. Moving to Russia, a source has told our friends at the Kyiv Independent that Ukraine's State Security Service, that's the SBU, hit two oil depots in Russia's Krasnodar Krai near the village of Yurovka overnight on May the 9th. if confirmed, this would be more examples of Kyiv's campaign against Russian energy infrastructure, which aims to limit the Federation's exports and energy industry. There's also in Ukraine been further reshuffles at the top of the military establishment. We'll go through the names and we'll do some analysis on this tomorrow, I think. But President Volodymyr Zelensky has dismissed Colonel Serhiy Lupanchuk from his role as the commander of the Special Operations Forces, the SOF. This is according to a presidential decree published online on May the 9th. And a separate decree announced that Brigadier General Oleksandr Trepak is the unit's new commander. As I said, we'll hopefully dig into that a little bit more tomorrow and what that means. A couple more stories from me then. There's a fascinating story from The Guardian, who write that Lithuania's foreign minister has raised the prospect of an ad hoc coalition of Western countries sending military training personnel into Ukraine backed by ground-based air defense. This is days after Russia took an increasingly strident tone against what it sees as the deeper threat of Western involvement in the war. So The Guardian had a chat with Gabrielis Landsbergis after his meeting with David Cameron. He told diplomatic editor Patrick Wintour, just some quotes here from Gabrielis, "Our troops have been training Ukrainians in Ukraine before the war, and we've been doing that for many years, so returning to this tradition might be quite doable. This could be a first step in President Macron's initiative." He said that a proposal to train Ukrainians inside their own country was, quote, "more practical than the training taking place on the territory of NATO members. Quote, you don't need to transport them all the way. You have everything that they need right there. It could be that the trainers stationed as part of the coalition to train Ukrainians in Ukraine could be defended with air defense. And that, in turn, implies that part of the Ukrainian sky could be defended with air defense." He said the move would tell Putin that it's not up to him to decide the way that we're helping Ukraine. Instead, we'll see what is needed and we adapt to the situation, because the situation is not getting better. He ended by saying that the Lithuanian parliament has already given the government a mandate to train inside Ukraine, but this would be best done as part of a bigger coalition. Just linked to that, of course, I mean, everything he said recalls to my mind everything that Pavlo Kurienko, one of the brigadier commanders of the Special Presidential Brigade, told me a couple of months ago, this idea that actually if you're looking to scale up training, then you really have to do it inside Ukraine, just because of the time involved it takes to take troops out of the country, to bring them back, you know, and the sheer the limitation, really, on the number of soldiers you can actually move around Europe to get training. So that's interesting, of course, that the Lithuanians are now singing from the same hymn sheet. Finally, then, back to Ukraine. Ukraine's parliament on Wednesday has passed a bill that would enable some prisoners to fight in the armed forces. This is, of course, in the context of Ukraine facing a critical shortage of manpower on the front line. After being long opposed to the measure and having previously criticised Moscow's mobilisation of prisoners to fill its ranks, Kyiv has made an about-turn after the fresh Russian advances on the battlefield. This legislation does need to be signed off by the chairman of the Rada, that's the country's parliament, and Zelensky, but before coming into force. MP Lena Shuliak, the head of Mr. Zelensky's party, has said the parliament has voted yes. The draft law opens the possibility for certain categories of prisoners who expressed a desire to defend their country to join the defence forces, she added. Mobilisation would be voluntary and only open to certain categories of prisoners. Amongst those not eligible, to serve include those found guilty of sexual violence, killing two or more people, serious corruption, and former high-ranking officials. This is all from Ms. Shuliak. And only prisoners with under 3 years left on their sentences can apply. Just to remind ourselves, Russia has recruited prisoners for many, many months, years, to serve on the front lines since early in the invasion, initially offering presidential pardons for 6 months' service. And, of course, as we've said, more than 2 years into this war, Kyiv is grappling with how to recruit enough soldiers to repel the intensification of Russian attacks. Well, that's all the military and military-linked updates that I have. James Rothwell, can I turn to you? You've been watching the Victory Day parade in Moscow. What have you been seeing?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Well, this year's military parade was pretty low-key, if you're going to compare it to sort of pre-invasion parades. Back in 2020, for example, there were at least 20 Russian-Soviet tanks on display. This year, just one lonely, solitary, sad old T-34, which in fact was also the case in the 2023 Victory Day parade as well. This is, of course, a moment of great sort of pomp and self-gratulation and ceremony for Vladimir Putin. The Victory Day celebration sort of began as celebrating, as you know, victory over the Nazi regime, Nazi Germany, 79 years ago. But he's sort of twisted and tortured the event in the eyes of his critics as a sort of propaganda display that seeks to equate the Nazis of the 1940s with what Putin has these very sort of ludicrous claims of there being lots of Nazis in Ukraine too. We all know that's the sort of political game the victory parade plays. A couple of other things I noticed, slightly unusual. There was a sort of march past at one point of these quite sort of striking female soldiers, all in sort of white skirts and gold belts and sort of these kind of large, dare I say it, slightly sort of fascistic knee-length boots. Quite unusual military uniforms, skirts above the knee and that sort of thing, sort of beaming at the Russian president as they sort of marched through. And there was actually, interestingly, I think platoon would be the right word, of about 12 men from the Central African Republic. CAR soldiers also took part in the parade. That's, of course, trying to reflect Wagner's growing influence across the African continent. They've also been in Burkina Faso recently and elsewhere. So it looked like a sort of, dare I say it, slightly kind of impotent attempt at sort of projecting Russia as a great military power. You know, lots of big talk from Putin himself about the fact that, you know, he won't bow to the West and all the usual sorts of remarks that we've come to expect from the Russian leader. But when you've got just one miserable Russian tank on display, presumably because all your others are out fighting or have been destroyed by Ukraine, you know, the content doesn't quite match the language of the event.
James, just quickly then, I mean, you've been watching this obviously for The Telegraph, you'll be writing us up. What do you think is the top line? What are you thinking for your headline? What do you think stands out the most that our listeners would appreciate hearing your thought process here?
I thought it was very interesting that Putin admitted his country was going through, and I quote, a difficult period. Visually, it was quite similar to last year. There was even an appearance from Lukashenko's white Pomeranian, who was sort of waddling around as Putin and his cronies sort of sat in the front row. And of course, no Western leaders there. They've been shunning this event ever since the invasion. So that also adds to the sort of image of an isolated Russian leader. And, you know, with each passing year, it feels less and less like a commemoration of the Second World War and feels more and more like an attempt to basically justify this one.
Just very quickly, James, did you feel watching it particularly intimidated? Or, I mean, it sounds as if you thought it was just a bit sad, really.
I thought it was a little bit sad. I mean, allow me to expand somewhat on why I think it's a bit sad. You know, we know that I think somewhere in the region of 27 million Soviet soldiers died during World War II fighting the Nazis. We know that that was an immense sacrifice made by Russia. And to see, you know, an event commemorating that sacrifice sort of morph really into a post facto propagandistic justification of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, I think makes it a pretty depressing watch for most people in the West. Of course, I can't speak for Russians themselves who, you know, may support the invasion of Ukraine. They may find this morale boosting. You know, they may find that this speaks to some inner desire, you know, to feel like a sort of big, strong, powerful country. But, you know, inevitably, it's a bit depressing.
Thank you very much, James, for your report there. Let's go to Roland. Roland, you've been looking at some of the diplomatic and political updates, but I don't know if you would like to comment on what James has just said there. I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, I think he covered it pretty well. I mean, look, I'm glad he picked up the baton on this one, to be honest, because I've reported those parades for, I mean, more than a decade of I just couldn't look at another one, to be absolutely honest. They're always the same. I mean, like, you can count the number of tanks and so on and so forth, but it's such a routine. And James is absolutely right about the way this commemoration has been perverted. There is a good reason to march in commemoration of defeating the Nazis. No one's going to, you know, disagree with that. And then, what is it, back in 2010, what would that be, like the 55th, 65th anniversary of the victory? I mean, British soldiers marched on Red Square to commemorate that victory. There are good reasons for marking that. But, I mean, yeah, certainly since the full-scale invasion, of course, it's, you know, the parallels, the way it's been linked, kind of, it's just become so explicit, the way the Kremlin has sought to leverage the memory of the Second World War with its current ambitions in Ukraine. But that's just explicit. I mean, that was already starting in kind of from when this war first began in 2014, to be honest. 10 years ago, the very cynical kind of exploitation of that memory and the manufacturing of that myth to justify aggression abroad was already well underway. And it is, as James says, deeply, deeply depressing. There's another, I'll finish with my kind of Russia, Russia whispering kind of thing. But there is another reason for doing that, right, which could be less sinister, and that's because basically after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, Russia was a country without an ideology. You know, the Kremlin was casting around for something to knit the country together, and what they came on was like victory in 1945. And that could have been a reasonable thing to build your national myth on. But they've taken that and they've turned it into what it is today. And you could, okay, here's a thought. I think there is a way, possibly, you could make a case that they've spent so much time obsessing about that war in an unhealthy way that they've actually become the very thing they say they're proud to have defeated. And you can see that in their behavior and kind of how they channel weird Nazi stuff. But I'll leave that there. That's a much bigger conversation. Thank you very much, James, for covering that today.
Roland, you've been looking then at some of the other diplomatic and political updates. Can you talk us through what you've seen? What should our listeners be aware of today?
Yes. So I know you touched on the Britain expelling the Russian defense attaché as an undeclared intelligence agent. There's not yet, as far as I can tell, a massive update on that. But that is definitely something to watch in terms of Britain's relations with Russia. But the big thing that broke, I think, after the podcast yesterday, so I think you missed it, is that the EU countries agreed yesterday afternoon to use an estimated 3 billion euros, it's about 2.6 billion pounds, don't ask me in dollars, in profits from frozen Russian assets to buy weapons for Ukraine. And this is a big breakthrough because there's been a big push from Ukraine asking its allies basically to confiscate Russian assets frozen in the West to fund its war effort. And there's been a lot of pushback. There's been a lot of kind of agonizing about, what are the legal implications? Would it undermine the rule of law? What about, Russia retaliating, so on and so forth? So this is what the Europeans have come up with. So what they've done is they've frozen about 181 billion pounds in Russian central bank assets, so specifically Russian central bank assets, that are held in Euroclear, which is a financial services company based in Belgium. Now, it's a bit complicated and there's a lot of like fine print, but the basic way it's going to work is this. Euroclear will hand over about 3 billion euros, 2.6 billion pounds a year, which will be transferred biannually beginning in July. And that is interest taken from the frozen assets. It's not the frozen asset itself, it's just the interest. And that's minus a certain amount of money that's going to be held back for liabilities and management fees and other kinds of things. But basically, 2.6 billion pounds hand over biannually. 90% of that will be used for buying weapons. And the remaining 10% is going to be earmarked for reconstruction. And that's a concession to countries like, Hungary, which is a NATO member, but obviously very publicly opposes sending weapons to Ukraine. But also the neutral EU countries, Austria, Malta, Cyprus, Ireland, those countries who kind of said, we need to show that some of this money is going to non-military purposes. So quite a breakthrough, I think. It will be welcomed by Ukraine. But do bear in mind, this comes after EU members, including France, Germany, Italy, the real big players. They basically rejected an earlier request by Ukraine, which was, by the way, supported by the United States, to just flat out confiscate, I think it's about 260 billion pounds in frozen Russian assets across the bloc. But it is a breakthrough. It's something the Ukrainians have been looking for a long time. And if it's, if it starts being handed over in July, that's something that will come online quite quickly. I'm going to run through a few of the other little things. First of all, across the Atlantic, in America, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, has survived an attempt by hardline Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene to remove him as Speaker. That was yesterday. So most of the Republicans, 217-213 House majority, backed him. So did Donald Trump, and some Democrats also voted for him, actually, because they didn't want any more chaos. Now, I think that's significant. We don't know how significant, but remember, Johnson was a man who, basically was instrumental in holding up that really crucial American aid package for 6 months. And then his kind of conversion from skeptic to kind of, national security orthodoxy, when he said, no, actually, I've seen the intelligence reports, was pretty much key in getting that going. So possibly a hopeful sign for the Ukrainians in Congress. Some international visits. Nikol Pashinyan, the Prime Minister of Armenia, is in Moscow today. He is seeing Vladimir Putin. We know that he has to walk a bit of a tightrope. Pashinyan, Armenia, a traditional ally of Moscow, they feel let down that the Russians didn't stand up for them in their recent wars with Azerbaijan's attacks on Nagorno-Karabakh. He's a westernizer. He is looking for new allies in the West, but it's a very, very tricky line for him to walk. The main takeaway from that at the moment is that the Kremlin says they've agreed to withdraw about several thousand peacekeepers at the Armenians' request, which reduces Russia's footprint there. There's still going to be Russian border guards on Armenia's borders with Iran and Turkey. That tricky, tricky line that those neighbors of Russia caught between East and West have to walk, that continues. Worth keeping an eye on. And the other big players, Xi Jinping is in Hungary today. That's his third stop on his European tour. He's previously in France and Serbia. Now, China is a big investor in Hungary. I think it's the single largest destination for investment in the EU. We're expecting a big announcement about, I think, an EV factory from him and Viktor Orban shortly. Tight relationship between Hungary and China. Hungary obviously keen to benefit from Chinese investment. China is actually kind of quite sure of European allies at the moment. Hungary is that country that's bucking the trend of the push from Brussels, basically, to, I think the phrase is de-risk relations with China. But you can expect Ukraine to come up somewhere in the talks. We don't know where. Obviously, you know, we know Viktor Orban's position on the Ukraine war. He opposes arms supplies. He's convinced that at the risk of getting a, you know, getting a fake complaint from the Hungarians for getting it wrong, I'm pretty sure their official position is, look, we want peace as soon as possible. So stop sending arms to stop prolonging the war, which, you know, many people may interpret as effectively pro-Russian position. The Hungarians would bitterly, bitterly dispute that in public, I should make clear. But, you know, the Europeans, other European partners will be watching this quite closely because, of course, China is, you know, officially neutral on the war, but also definitely in this loose anti-Western alliance with Russia. So definitely a relationship to watch. And lastly, over in the Pacific, since we're talking about China, President Yoon Suk-yeol has given an interview, a quite rare interview, that he was mostly addressing his party's high performance in recent elections. But he was asked about Ukraine. He said, look, we want to maintain a smooth relationship with Russia. And he ruled out direct weapons shipments to Ukraine, which reaffirms their position before. The South Koreans have sold weapons that have ended up in Ukraine before. But his line is, Russia's been a good partner for quite some time. The war in Ukraine and Moscow's use of weapons from North Korea has made ties, quote, is uncomfortable. So again, this interesting balancing that many countries have had to do around this war. Korea, you know, anxious not to really upset the Russians, but very upset and quite worried about Russia's tightened ties with North Korea. And we know that North Korean weapons have shown up in Ukraine and missiles from North Korea have been used by the Russians to strike Ukrainian cities. So that is more or less the diplomatic landscape today. I'll hand back to you, David, unless you think there is something that we have missed.
No, that's brilliant. Thank you so much, Roland. And James, will come back to both of you at the end for your final thoughts. Just a quick note on that point you made, Roland, there about the North Korean missiles. I've seen one of them and held one of them in Kyiv on my last trip, and that will be out in a documentary in the next month or so. So do listen out for that. I must admit, it was just a sort of shell of a much, you know, a part of the shell casing, essentially. And it was very interesting talking to the investigators, explaining how did they know it was North Korean? What were they looking for? How did it differ from other Russian munitions? So that was fascinating. And as I said, that will be out in an episode, a bonus episode, in the coming months. Let's go, though, to our guest, Aliona Hlivka. Aliona, it's great to have you back, managing director of the Henry Jackson Society. You've written a paper on Russia's wartime influence inside Ukraine. Before we talk about where we are today in May 2024, can you set the scene for us and talk us through how you see that influence being activated and used up until the full-scale invasion? Aliona Hlivka.
Thank you, David. It's great to be back with the Telegraph team. Yes, as you've rightly mentioned, I have written a very interesting paper for the Baltic Defense College, which is one of NATO educational facilities on the eastern flank. and they have finally started looking very closely and intentively at how the Russian war machine works, what hybrid warfare techniques they're using and applying. And in fact, having looked at the 30 years of independence of Ukraine that I have mostly lived, well, half of that I was a student and another half I've spent in Ukrainian politics. So I have seen some of these covert influences right in front of me. And it, of course, was very difficult to put all the puzzles together at the time. But then once you actually start seeing the patterns and start seeing how they influence not just Ukraine, but then how they kind of scale up and apply the same methods now in Europe and across the world effectively, you can start seeing some real trends, not just of Russian warfare, but in fact of the future of war. And that is something that I started looking at quite closely as one of the elements of my research. So I go back to looking at the beginning of the 90s when the Soviet Union collapsed and Ukraine became an independent country. And since then, you can see Russia being very tight about keeping Soviet Union effectively together, despite that, as many Russian elites at the time said, that something went wrong and the Union was not meant to collapse. And it was the biggest mistake that Russian elites have ever done, letting the three republics, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and at the time Russian Republic, to make that decision in the Belovezh Forest. To let all the countries go their own way and just establish the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, that was functioning for quite a long time, with eventually some members also leaving. So since then, I've divided basically Ukraine's independence years in three stages, where Russia has used various approaches to their influence across Ukraine, capitalizing on all the same things that we're seeing now in the Western society. It's the division of the society wherever they can fit and wherever they can spread the cracks. It's the infiltration of political elites, founding and financing of political parties. It's infiltration of corruption and enormous covert operations. In that sense, control over critical industries of Ukraine, of course, creating a huge dependence on Russian energy supplies, something that has become quite pertinent in Europe as well, and all of the other very obvious and very blunt attacks, all the way going to assassination attempts. And we have seen several of those unleashed on Ukrainian officials, and the most recent one with two of the security officers being arrested in Ukraine who were actually plotting the kidnapping and assassination of President Zelensky, which I'm sure you've covered, and going all the way back to end of last year with the assassination attempts of General Kirill Budanov and his wife and several of the defense intelligence officers of Ukraine. So going back to the three stages that I divide in Ukraine, which is quite important because we can draw parallels with Europe and with what's going on in the world right now. From 1991, the independence of Ukraine, all the way to 2014, there were various attempts to undermine Ukraine in the geopolitical sphere. So through the disinformation, through recruitment of European elites, we don't need to go back too far, looking at the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder or the former French Finance Minister François Fillon, who went on to work for Russia in their big companies after being the strongest supporter of Russia in Europe. We have seen some infiltration of political parties in Ukraine at that time and sponsorship of what's critically to understand, not just the pro-Russian parties, because that was the main division in Ukraine, as I've mentioned many times before in this podcast, that Ukrainian society was always divided between the older generations who looked into the past towards the former Soviet Union and unity with Slavic states, and, you know, the glorious past that Russia is still applying quite actively in Russia, and the Western future in Europe, assimilation of the youth, the opportunities to travel, investments, just having some decent and basic human rights and freedoms that the Western societies enjoy. So that was the main division. But Russians have managed not just to sponsor political parties who were functioning on the east of that ideological spectrum, and many of those parties I name in my paper, if you go ahead and look at it, they have also sponsored the far-right parties in Ukraine. And that is the trend that we have seen also in Europe, with extreme right-wing parties who are now propagating Russian values and stepping in to say that we need to finish this war and we don't need to support Ukraine. Russia has already played all of those tricks on Ukraine when they have tried to use those officials, shall I say, and politicians from the Western Ukraine who were saying all the right things in terms of assimilation with the West, and yet were a bit too far on the spectrum and were later used to build this whole narrative of Russia being, Ukraine being full of Nazis and fascists and all the rest. So that has been planted in Ukraine quite successfully. The next stage is the actual military invasion. So 2014 to 2022, when they have failed with the second invasion, it's important to remember that that was the period of kinetic warfare on Ukraine. The first invasion of Ukraine happened in 2014 with annexation of Crimea and then the east of the country. There were some sanctions implemented by the West on Russia after that, but most of them by 2022 were lifted. Russia was back on the international arena as if nothing has happened. And effectively, Russia was forgiven for their violation of another sovereign state's borders and sovereignty. In 2022, when they have seen that there is absolutely no reaction to Russian invasion of Ukraine, that Crimea is effectively was recognized as Russian, when all the elections of Putin and his parliament that were being held on the occupied Ukrainian territories were all legitimized by the West, they decided to go further and move in further into Ukraine. So they conducted their second invasion, this time from the east, the south, and the north, most importantly trying to target Kyiv and overthrow the Ukrainian government. So that was their blindedness on being quite drunk on power and sense of impunity, thinking that they got away with the first invasion, so they can definitely now go on with whatever capacities they had militarily, which we've later learned that were not that great, to go on with the second invasion. Now, when they have learned that militarily, because of corruption and the decay of Russian army, everything that you've discussed on this podcast quite extensively, when they have learned that that did not go through well, because Kyiv is still standing to this day and Ukraine has effectively fought back a lot of territory and liberated several towns and regions of Ukraine, they have went back to their covert methods of influence. And that includes many methods that we're seeing now, the infiltration of Russian spies in Ukraine and across Europe. We have seen several examples of Russian spies being detained in Germany, in Poland. The whole network was brought down. We have seen, obviously, the allegations and the accusations and now the expelling of Russian so-called diplomats here in London. And there are many more. And I'm sure we need to stay really vigilant because after their initial failure on the battlefield, Russia has gone back to all the known methods that they have applied before. We need to be very vigilant about spies, about spreading of disinformation on social media. And I will touch on the latest disinformation campaign that started in late 2023, if I can remember correctly. And that's something that President Zelensky even referred to as Maidan 3, the special operations that, according to some intelligence sources in Ukraine, has received a funding of about $230 million, if I'm not mistaken, just to fund that one social media campaign on talking about giving up on Ukraine, of, you know, Ukraine is fighting, losing battle, this is another forever war, they're losing ground in the east, the aid to Ukraine must not be voted in, and luckily we got through that, but as we could have seen, it went through not in the easiest way. And that is all part of that concerted effort to just make people forget about Ukraine, make people give up on Ukraine, and make Ukrainians themselves give up on this fight. Because the scale of this information warfare and this operation that was waged on normal Ukrainians who are still trying to survive every day with their loved ones on the front line, even disseminating that information among soldiers on the front line. And I've heard those narratives from them that are being installed by Russian propaganda. It's deeply troubling how they infiltrate our societies and how they divide them, with everything on mobilization, on not having enough troops, of not having enough spirit to fight back. All of that was created and implemented as part of Russian information campaign. And here in the West, we've seen similar trends, of course, that I'm sure you have discussed many times, on giving up on Ukraine, another stage of Ukraine fatigue, etc. So all of that, without, of course, ignoring the fact that being at war for over 10 years and at the most brutal stage of war for the last more than 2 years, it's very difficult. And of course, people are giving up much of hope and much of faith that this war will end soon enough and that it could still end without much loss. But the spirit of Ukrainians and the resilience is still there. And luckily, the society still is cohesive enough and united enough around the president to withstand all of these campaigns. Because what is coming, actually, what's coming out of Ukrainian intelligence sphere is that on the 20th of May and onwards, we will, of course, see Russia having their advances on the battlefield. They are planning their spring/summer strong offensive campaign that Ukraine is bracing itself for. But on the information sphere, they are planning another attack on President Zelensky and saying that he's illegitimate because the elections were not held and this is the end of his term. And that's another narrative that will be populated in Ukraine and in the West quite broadly, trying to make the political infighting as pertinent and high on the agenda in Ukraine as possible, and spread the same narratives here in the West, just to delegitimize President Zelensky and almost force Western governments to take a step back without supporting Ukraine, because obviously they're dealing with quote-unquote illegitimate president. So that is yet to come, and we need to be prepared for that, and we need to draw lessons, because all of the countries in the West, the UK, the US, the European Union, are about to go through their own political campaigns and elections. So I think if we stay vigilant and look at all the methods that Russia is applying on Ukrainian battlefield, both kinetic and covert operations and influence campaigns and information war, we can draw on many lessons. And if we apply them here, then that will make the Western democracy is more resilient and ready to face the challenges of the modern world.
Well, Alyona, thank you so much for talking us through your thesis there. Just one question from me before. I don't know if Roland and James have questions as well, but I'm interested to hear your answer to, why does some of this work, especially within Ukraine? I mean, you've said you've seen these narratives propagated and you've seen people talking about them, but why do you think that they have the impact that they do within the country?
Well, they simply have the impact because Russians have learned all the weaknesses of societies. They know where some divisions lie. They hit where it hurts. They do the same with Ukrainians and they do the same with the rest of the world, Europeans, Americans, etc. If you look closely at what's happening, I've been talking for the last couple of months to my sister-in-law. And of course, you know that my brother is fighting on the front line. And it's very difficult for him, having extremely limited ammunition and supplies of any provision that they have, really, to fight back the Russians who are approaching in the northeast. But at the same time, I could see how my sister's view of the war has changed, because the only thing we talked about, and I tried to support her as much as I can with the two-year-old that she had and basically had been raising for the last 2 years on her own, she's talking about, where is the demobilization? My husband has been fighting for over 2 years in the front line now. When is he going to have a rotation? Because also that he is now, as an experienced fighter, will be on the front line until at least October of this year with no breaks, and again not seeing his family. So I've seen that in her rhetoric more and more, and I can see how on social media and all the social media that Ukrainians are using, one of which is quite troubling and which I'm trying to strongly urge against all of my friends and family back home, is TikTok. Those videos on TikTok are being spread viciously on all the failures of Ukrainian government, the failure to secure Western support, to get more weapons in, to rally behind common values. All the political divisions are kicking in. Some of the, what I think, extremely despicable political actors in Ukraine, their voices are not that loud, but as a Ukrainian, I can see them because I've seen their growth and rise and fall in Ukrainian politics in 13 years that I've been there. They are now also trying to capitalize on that and earn some potential scores for the elections that who knows when will happen. So it all comes into play. And similarly here in the West, when we see that, you know, Ukraine has lost one or two villages in the last few months, all of a sudden that's all we talk about, or at least mainstream media, the headlines is only about that. There are no headlines, unfortunately, about Ukraine managed to hold these territories despite having very little supplies, or Ukraine still controls the Black Sea, or Ukraine's AI defense sector is booming and thriving, and the production of drones is insane because it's now a grassroots level, and I don't know, almost 10% of Ukrainians are now producing drones in their garages. So it's still a very cohesive and joint effort to fight this war. But identifying the weaknesses and those social divisions that are present in each society and is something normal that is part of the fabric of every society, Russians have used very well how to weaponize those and how to divide people. So if I had one message to say, and that's the one that I say to my brother, that's the one that I try to communicate to my sister-in-law as much as I can, as well as the rest of my family, is the unity is the key, and questioning of every single thing we see on social media, seeing the sources, seeing how things are being phrased even, it's quite important, because that vigilance is the one invisible front line and the battlefield that we are all part of. And it's the responsibility of every single one of us, whether we're contributing to the good side or the bad side of this fight.
Coming up, we hear Roland, James, and Aliona's final thoughts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's proceed to our final thoughts. Roland Oliphant, would you like to go first?
My final thought, I will proceed with a plop. No, I don't have an intelligent question to ask, so it's probably best to read. I move on. What were your final thought? Yes, Alona was referred to the second half of May and what the Russians intend to do on the battlefield. We've been putting together quite a big read about this, which is going through the editing process. I think it's meant to run tomorrow. I'm not sure, but keep an eye on the website for that. Basically, as mentioned, there's a lot of talk about the Russians escalating their current offensive, whether this is going to take the form of a completely new offensive or an escalation we're already seeing. That's a debate we get into. But be aware, this month and the rest of summer are expected. That is the expectation. To be very, very challenging for the Ukrainians on the battlefield. So that is throwing things forward a couple of weeks. That is what we are going to be keeping our eyes on.
I think what I'll take away from today's episode, David, is the extent to which psychological pressure and mind games have such a profound impact, not just on the battlefield, but also on the civilian populations. We talked at the start of the episode about the way that Victory Day has been sort of perverted by Vladimir Putin. He's taken an event which is honouring the sacrifice of so many Russian and Ukrainian soldiers who died fighting the Nazi regime. He's taken that and he's turned it into a sort of post facto propagandistic justification of the war in Ukraine and the myth of Ukrainian Nazis and so on. So that's quite disturbing. But then, as Aliona says, there's also this immense hybrid warfare campaign underway to not just work on spying in Europe and recruiting what we sometimes call Putin's useful idiots, but also some sabotage attacks, potentially meddling in elections. And of course, as we discussed briefly, the way that platforms like TikTok are being used to sap Ukrainian morale in order to sort of weaken Ukrainians' resolves, to create the sort of false impression that this is going to be an unwinnable forever war and so on. And I think it really just illustrates how a war like this is just as much or almost as much being fought in the mind as well as on the battlefield for those who are directly involved in it and indeed indirectly involved. So that's what I'm taking away from today's episode.
Thank you very much, Roland and James. Aliona, very quickly, your final thoughts, please.
I would like to echo exactly what James said. I think we're living in the era of hybrid wars, and we need to be extremely vigilant about that. That demands not just attention on the battlefield for the warriors and fighters. It now demands an extreme attention from all of us as members of society having extreme agency. We are living at the times where every single voice can be heard and can be amplified through social media and other various platforms. And we're living obviously in eras where those minds and hearts can be influenced and those voices can be altered and used against us, against social cohesions, against unity of societies and eventually the Western alliances and the world, the safe world, as we know it now, even though it's getting more dangerous and the war is encroaching upon us from all sides. And just before we started the live podcast, Roland and I discussed whether we're living in the Third World War already or not yet. So I think if this paper aimed to look at the past and explain how Russia developed its methods and how it applied it, if I could draw out the potential analysis and the forecast of the nearest future as I see it playing out now, we need to be very careful. 2024 is crucial because it's the year of elections everywhere, and Russia will try to meddle in every single election that is happening now in the world. They need to secure the ambivalence of Western elites. They need to secure the division amongst Western countries and societies, and disrupt the stability of our societies as much as they can. So they will play on anything from political divisions to identity politics to disinformation and all the plethora of techniques that they have. Once this year is over and certain governments are in place, and they will of course try to put in the politicians who they favor, who would be the least harmful for Russian expansionism, 2025 will be the year when many things could be divided. On the battlefields in Ukraine, perhaps in Israel, we will see how China will react to everything that's going on with the Ukraine war and Russia, and whether it will become aggressive in Indo-Pacific or not. And many reports are now coming out of the Western intelligence agencies and of Ukraine itself that in 2027, Russia will be fully prepared to wage a war on NATO states, fully rearmed and weaponized to its teeth with all the weapons, drones, ballistic missiles, and in cohesion with North Korea, Iran, and potentially maybe China. So what we're deciding now is we're putting in leadership to try to resolve this looming imminent threat that is hanging over our planet, not to over-exaggerate, but we need to be very sober in knowing this, that the bigger threat is coming, actually. And who we decide on now, how we stay united, how we don't fall for any sensationalist statements online and not rush to conclusions and just take one day at a time and try to make the best decision in each and every single day, it will without exaggeration define the future and the security of our world within the next couple of years.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis, and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine Live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to podcast apps. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode.
Ukraine the Latest is produced by Louisa Wells and Giles Gere.